Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of The Negotiation. I am your host, Todd Embley. And on today's show, we welcome back WPIC CEO Jacob Cook to share insights around two pivotal developments for global consumer brands, the framework trade agreement between the U.S. and China, and China's massive 618 shopping festival. Jacob breaks down the implications of the new framework agreement between the U.S. and China and explains how tariff policies are shifting brand strategy and highlights key recommendations for both U.S. and non-U.S. companies looking to grow in APAC. He also shares what's different about this year's 618 shopping event, how platforms like Taobao and Xiaohongshu are integrating content and commerce, and which product categories are set to win big. If you're a global brand navigating China's trade and consumer landscape, this is one episode you don't want to miss. Enjoy.
I don't think it presents any challenges. I think what's just important for operators like us is that we know where those trends are and where they're going. And we're not spending an overly large proportion of your advertising dollars in tier one, where the growth is happening in tier three, four, and five. We always do in e-commerce want to know where the puck is going, and we want to be there well in advance of where those trends are. And that goes with the platforms, you know, we talked about, you know, PDD and things like that and Redbook and all these other ones as well. And really understanding where the investments are going to go from those platforms and being there to sort of follow and scoop up a lot of those benefits.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to The Negotiation, brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies. Jacob, welcome back to The Negotiation Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Where are you in the world today? You have a different background once again.
Yeah, I'm just in one of the unused meeting rooms in our Tokyo office today.
Okay. Now, you guys just released the WPIC Strategic Tariff Report. Can you share its key findings and why now was the time to publish it?
Well, I think the timing is obvious. We're going through a rapid change in tariffs. And the June 2025 report really outlines the current tariff environment and the implications for American and non-American global brands. Tariff policies have created a lot of uncertainty for global brands. What we wanted to do is provide a roadmap to handle this uncertainty while also identifying where there's going to be a lot of growth opportunities. You know, for U.S. brands that manufacture in China, there's an opportunity to use that inventory in other APAC markets or sell, you know, into China, you know, tariff-free via cross-border e-commerce. And then for non-U.S. brands, there's, you know, an imperative to diversify away from the U.S. market and sell into China and other parts of Asia where many American brands might be pulling back. So, you know, advantages and pricing has really changed, which has opened up opportunities.
You have a London deal between the U.S. and China, trying to parse how that works. Tell us about that deal and how do you assess the current landscape and its implications for brands?
Well, under the new framework, what's been agreed on so far at a high level is tariffs on U.S. goods going into China are going to be taxed at 10%, and Chinese goods going into the U.S. will be taxed at 55%. You know, brands shouldn't really expect a return to, you know, pre-trade war normal with low tariffs. That never happened, even if administrations changed. And this deal sort of reinforces, you know, the need for long-term hedging and flexibility, you know, in trade strategy. We're really expecting, you know, some stability in the relationship coming out of this, but uncertainty does remain high. And especially with, you know, ongoing litigation in U.S. courts and election year, you know, volatility, you know, we're hoping that our brands, you know, stay nimble and proactive and are able to be flexible, you know, with where inventory can be moving around.
Now, we have to pivot to the 618. Maybe just off the top, remind people what the 618 is real quick. And then let's talk about expectations for the performance of this year's festival.
Yeah. So I think, you know, 618, I don't know, I've lost track, whether they're year 15, 16, 17, something like that. It's really been here since, you know, the the birth of e-commerce in China. And it basically, there's two major holidays every year that are total consumer holidays, you know, not, you know, masquerading in religious holidays. They're just straight up consumer holidays. 618 or Liu Yao Ba has, you know, lucky number in China, same thing with 1111. And those are really the two major days for shopping. And that's when customers, you know, for e-commerce are really expecting to get the lowest prices on products throughout the entire year. So you see stocking up on, you know, FMCG, as well as some of those larger ticket items where that's going to be the lowest price of the year. So, you know, we're expecting, again, strong year-over-year growth. It's a little bit different in terms of being able to predict this because the format's changed a little bit. But, you know, we have absolutely seen consumer confidence be rebounding in 2025. And you know, the latest numbers that we have from even April, retail sales were up 5.1%. You know, and recent holidays, again, you know, consumption has set, you know, spending records. So very positive in terms of what we're looking at this year in terms of growth.
We've had conversations, and I know that nothing is ever the same in that area of the world. But what is going to be different about this year's 618?
I think for consumers, it was a little bit more simplified. You know, the discount stacking mechanisms, which made things complicated for brands, you know, it's a little bit easier. It's also more leveled out over the festival. So obviously, you know, 15, 16, 17, 18, we're going through a little bit of a boom right now. But the discounts have been going less into, you know, we would look at this festival being 25 days, but 2 days here, 2 days there, and it really jammed it up. What we're seeing is a much more consistent sales day over day, making it easier for the operators, which we love. Also, it's a bit more transparent for consumers too, in terms of not being so complicated in terms of when can I get the best deal. You know, at other trends in terms of live streaming and creator-led campaigns are getting more targeted. You know, AI is not only helping in the generative content creation, but it's also allowed for very targeted segmentation by not only the platforms, but getting good information back to the creators too, that are really segmenting those audiences out, which is really great. So in terms of, you know, maybe you don't need to buy the entire 15 million off of a very popular influencer's audience. And if you're after, you know, pet owners, there's plenty of influencers now that might target that 3.5 million, making it a lot more efficient because it has been a very expensive way to market. Oh, and another thing too, it's really tier 3 to tier 5 too. That's something that we've noticed as well, which is good growth in cities. You know, one of the exercises I've always loved is going to the warehouse and just going through the boxes that are coming out the door. And there's not a time where I don't learn a new city. And this comes from somebody who's been, you know, in China for 15 years. So it's almost a geography lesson, just looking at where the quieties are going out. And it this trend has been going on for a while, but really getting down into all the way to the bottom, which is tier 5, basically. And even, you know, cross-border deals going on there too. So that's great to see. And it's really sort of leveling out consumption out of those tier 1 cities. And, you know, we saw tier 2, tier 3, and now even going down further. So that's great in terms of development. And that's really going to help expand the consumption base. Because if you look at the demographics in a lot of those tier 3, tier 4, tier 5, you're a lot younger too. So it's good. I think that's where we're going to see a lot of consumption growth the next couple of years too.
Okay, interesting. I'd like to actually ask a follow-up question to that then. Okay, how many tiers are there? I've actually never, you might know better than I would. Do you know?
There should be no more than 5, but there's people that reference even more than that too. I mean, we started with 3, but I'm not sure. I think an official where this comes from is classifications on government spending, and I believe it goes to 5.
Is there anything that changes when you get into the 4, the 5, maybe the 6? Like logistics, you know, promises of shipping times, returns, any of these kinds of things that...
Yeah, I mean, the return rates are probably pretty consistent. The logistics network, as you know, is incredible. So as it's been built out, and it's just made it easier to get to those places and reduce the cost of getting to those places. I mean, if you look at stimulus spending over the last 10 years, so much of it has been infrastructure, trains, highways that were built well before their time. So nothing's really at capacity yet. So is it different? I don't know. Just maybe a little bit behind on the development scale to where the tier ones first. It was just, you know, probably prioritized in terms of tier. But, you know, like I said, it's, you know, inflation, especially in real estate and property, never got up to the way it was in tier one. And and people are living in bigger homes. Family units are larger, and you know, they've been having a lot more kids, quite frankly. So
does it present any challenges on your side going from shipping or dealing with tier one to tier five?
I don't think it presents any challenges. I think what's just important for operators like us is that we know where those trends are and where they're going. And we're not spending an overly large proportion of your advertising dollars in tier one, where the growth is happening in tier three, four, and five. We always do in e-commerce want to know where the puck is going, and we want to be there well in advance of where those trends are. And that goes with the platforms. You know, we've talked about, you know, PDD and things like that, and Redbook and all these other ones as well, and really understanding where the investments are going to going from those platforms and being there to sort of follow and scoop up a lot of those benefits.
A little bit on content commerce integrations. How are the platforms content commerce integrations, such as like Taobao, Xiaohongshu, the Red Cat plan, shaping consumer discovery?
Well, this is, you know, world leading in what's going on here. What's also really helpful for us as you know, being in the Tokyo office is really getting these trends from China and training our teams, you know, that exist in Korea and Japan and other parts of Asia, because we've so seen these trends once they emerge in China, they really spread throughout Asia. You know, the Red Cat plan is another major breakthrough. You know, Taobao is now going to leverage Xiaohongshu creators to create and bridge lifestyle content with native commerce. So it's a great partnership. You know, we've been very bullish on everything that Red Note has done this year. And I think it also reflects a broader shift, you know, toward ecosystem integrations. You know, we talked about those walled gardens coming down, I think, you know, probably 18 months ago to 2 years ago. And now we're really starting to see some of these very creative things. I think when we saw the apps put up those gardens, it really stifled innovation. And most of those have started to open up. There's been a lot of win-win and some really interesting stuff coming out of those collaborations. I think, you know, consumers are increasingly making, you know, purchasing decisions within content platforms, you know, not the traditional search bars from the e-commerce platforms.
Okay. All right. Now let's dive into product categories. Which product categories do you expect to perform strongest during 618? And what top three recommendations do you have for international brands to stand out?
Okay. Well, I'll start with the categories.
Start with the categories
here. Yeah. So, you know, beauty, international skincare, cosmetics, they're still booming. Even more so. And this has been a couple of year trend now. Health and supplements, again, this category continues to rise. And I think the influencers have done such an incredible job in that category by really, you know, pushing the benefits of those. Now, fashion and outdoor as well. I mean, that's something that's grown, but these hobbies, and we've talked about these, you know, trends to more experiential-based purchasing. Like, if there's no coincidence that the travel's way up, the outdoor's way up. If you look at those Arc'teryx numbers from January and Lululemon's numbers, they're really incredible. I mean, look, 75% growth in Arc'teryx, and this is not a new brand that should be experiencing these types of numbers. Yeah. They've been here for well over a decade. You know, Lululemon now doing 40% of global sales in China. And if you look at all those things, they all are related, you know, beauty, health and fitness, fashion and outdoor, look good, feel good. And that's really what's important. And, you know, it's still less on the super luxury side. And that has nothing to do with people spending less money or the economy. And you see this, you know, false equivalency all the time. I think in the media, you know, Arc'teryx and Lululemon are often a lot more expensive inside China than they are overseas. Arc'teryx especially. So, you know, people are very clearly willing to spend money, but it's just different. And the purchasing habits are different. But, you know, look better, feel better. I think that is, and enjoy yourself. You know, that's to me where I see the consumption trends here.
So I wanted to jump in on that. And before we get to the three brand recommendations, I'm curious if you have any opinions on where this came from, because when I spent my time in China, I think we could say anywhere from 2010 back, and you said you've only been in China for 15 years, but that's a lot. You've been there longer. It's got to be more closer to 20. But this wanting to look better, and that was funny because you keyed on that in your answer. I wanted to say this just all sounds like they just want to look better, just being active and getting healthy, getting in shape. You know, bodies look better, are more fit. And then obviously the health supplements that go along with that. And now they're, you know, fashion and skincare, and they're starting to get into makeup, all these kind of things. This is all around that same kind of look good, feel good. But this was not a thing, I'm going to say, you know, pre-2010, when I first got there, you know, we had the stories of the bazillionaires showing up with, you know, bags of cash, buying Bugattis with, you know, stains from lunch on their t-shirt and rips in their shorts and mismatching sandals. This was not a thing. There was companies that people ran that taught the wealthy which side of the plate a fork and a spoon should be placed on, you know, where you're sitting down. Where did this come from? Like, I mean, is this just a natural evolution of a country just growing up in it before our eyes, or what?
Very interesting question. I mean, yeah, certainly part of that, I think, would be growing up. I think that, you know, those people that you described did look ridiculous. And I think a lot of people did realize they did look ridiculous. And I think that, you know, if you want to go back to that time, wealth was probably really concentrated. You know, we knew things were rising and growing up, but now you've got a middle class where a lot of that purchasing behavior really rests on, you know, and we talk about the millions and millions of families and households that have the ability to spend, you know, $1,500 US on a jacket, take that several thousand dollar trip. And I think that's where a lot of it's coming from. I think that certainly some of it is a change in individual behavior where, you know, are these luxury items that, you know, I've been striving for, are they really bringing me happiness and joy? And at the end of the day, you know, maybe not. Probably a lot of the knockoff market has toned down the prestige. I think the luxury brands have done a horrible job of protecting their brands in China. And I think people just started to do some of these things and really enjoy it. Like, I mean, when you start going outside and you know, go on hikes and you start working out, I mean, you like it. You know, it releases those endorphins and it's something you want to continue to do, you know, and I think it's contagious as well. And, you know, if you're always trying to be that person buying the best bag and the best fashion, well, you're just something you're not going to win and something that's not going to bring a lot of peace and happiness to your life. So I think once people start to feel good and they get on that train of health and wellness, they stay on it. So I would say a lot of things, but maybe there's some sociologists out there that could answer that question better than Agreed. I do. But you know what? It's a great trend, and it's great to be living around people that are so into that. It makes life very interesting, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, it's great to see. Yeah, I've appreciated watching that all come to fruition. So now back, top three brand recommendations.
Okay, well, I think the easiest one there is cross-border e-commerce to avoid the tariffs. And the fact that the bonded free trade zones are the way that they are, if tariffs ever do change, by this fact that your inventory is in bonded, it can quickly be moved throughout Asia. You know, that's something that we've been setting up for the last 4 to 5 years. It's definitely at maturity now. And I think a reason that, you know, WPIC as a company is really winning for our clients in terms of the trade war, because we could just adapt in such a chaotic environment so quickly. Let's talk about content commerce, like doubling down on that. You know, and it maybe when we talk about that, you know, even companies like New Balance, you can understand where they're at is these investments that might be 12 to 18 months in the making in terms of getting that content out there and short form video out there. Really start to pay off, not in the first 3 to 6 months, but really from that 6, 12 to 18 point. And once you have it, they really help you to hold that market share so that you've got that moat. And it's very difficult for competitors to come up and get a piece of that. And then just localize and stay agile. You know, that might be a combination of the first two, but, you know, keep the SKUs fresh, you know, adopt to promotions quickly. As you see new trends, in the market, you know, I think it's, you know, you're going to see a lot of benefits for staying ahead of that stuff. And again, you know, not waiting for other people to go out and try it, but, you know, we know that Taobao and Xiaohongshu are great platforms. So, you know, when they say, you know, and they talk about a red cap plan, get involved immediately. And, you know, the brands and the platforms are going to reward that. You know, they love partners that are willing to go out there and be very quick and adapt very quickly. So I think those three things are going to carry you well through the rest of the year. And then we'll talk in the New Year's show, if you invite me back, about what we see for 2026. But that's about as far forward as we're looking right now. I think these trends are going to carry through to the end of the year, very, very consistently.
Surprise question. Okay. Is Xiaomi a company worth investing in for those that are investors right now?
Well, I think that, you know, there's obviously a lot of chaos out there, but I've always liked Xiaomi. I think, you know, their ability to get into these product areas is incredible. Their ability also to copy sort of what Shein is doing with AI and understanding trends and come up with those products very, very quickly. Yeah, I'm pretty bullish on it. And, you know, as long as there's no restrictions put in on Chinese companies, which keeps U.S. capital out of them, I think they're going to do very well. I think they have done very well, and they're going to continue.
Well, their phone processors, I hear, are starting to kind of rival what Apple has. And now they're in the EV market, if I'm not mistaken, as well.
Sure are. Yeah.
And they've been quiet.
Great looking cars.
Yeah. And they've been quiet for some time. And what the rumblings I'm hearing is that they have just been heads down, letting other brands eat up all the oxygen in the room while they have just been just focused on R&D. And we're going to start seeing some really amazing things out of them.
Yeah, I would agree with that. You see, don't underestimate to really the Shein model too, like that whole AI model where they're scanning the internet, coming up with trends, finding stuff, and they just sit back and watch. If that product does really well, well, they're going to come up with a cheaper version that might even be better, much cheaper, and they're going to have it to market in an extremely low amount of time, similar to what Shein does. You know, they see a trend on Instagram, they're going to have that product out and being shipped 5 days later. It's ridiculous how fast that is. But that's a model that Xiaomi is adopting too. And hard to not be super successful doing that.
Yeah. Okay, great. Last question. Stanley Cup playoffs. Does Edmonton have what it takes to come back down 3-2 in the series against Florida?
Yeah, well, they proved it last year. I think it's obviously, if they can win game six, they're going to win game seven. That's my prediction. I think Polymarket backs that up for me too as well. If we're going to get to game seven, I think you're going to see Edmonton the favorite on Polymarket.
Okay. Well, game seven is in Edmonton, so they just got to get back home and then all bets are off. All right.
Agreed.
Jacob Koch, CEO of WPIC. Thank you very much for coming on the show with us once again. We really enjoyed you.
Thanks, Todd. Always a pleasure.
Okay, so for everybody who is watching and or listening, please don't forget to subscribe, to like, let us know how we're doing, give us guest recommendations. All of that really, really does help us. If you do have a guest recommendation and you want to email something over, hit us up at podcast@wpic.co. Big shout out and thank you to the team behind the negotiation as well. Thank you for all you do. I probably do not say that enough live on the podcast. So to all of you behind the scenes pulling your weight, thank you very much for doing what you do. So on behalf of them and on myself and on behalf of Jacob Koch, thank you very much for listening and or watching. We'll see you next time.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.